Runoff, a crime novel about election fraud, evokes a curious timelessness of classic detective fiction. A noir gem, says Mystery Scene Magazine. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 14, Playing Footsie. I hung out with Chow until the fire department arrived. They couldn't get their truck up the narrow alley, so they parked it at the mouth, and three of them came charging along with a hose, rubber masks clamped on their faces, and oxygen tanks strapped to their backs. Chow pointed at the stairway and said, "Second floor, but the fire's out. You won't need any of that." The taller of the three who was bringing up the rear said, "We'll see," in a muffled voice, and they elbowed through the doorway. A few minutes later, we heard heavy boots coming down the stairs, and a piece of charred envelope on the end of a back scratcher appeared in the doorframe. It was followed by the tall guy who held the scratcher at arm's length. He'd pulled the oxygen mask off to reveal a shock of unruly red hair and a big red face with an even redder mark from the mask. "Here's your incendiary device." Chow nodded. "That's right. It was sent to me in the mail. I opened it and it exploded."
"Fizzled first," I put in, "then exploded."
"Yeah," said Chow, "after I'd thrown it the hell away." The fireman drew his upper lip over flecked teeth like a bad Bogart impressionist.
"Well, you're lucky it wasn't plastic explosive. You'd both be dead. From what you say and what I can make out from the bits that are left, it was probably a black powder device. We'll bag this and bring it to the bomb guys for more analysis. But I'm 99% certain that that's what they'll come back with."
I stifled a cough in the crook of my arm. "But what about the fizzling? Was it supposed to do that, or was it a dud?"
"Could have been either. It might have been set to do a quick burn at first to give you a scare, or the powder or the detonator might have been bad, which caused part of the charge to burn off before it exploded. The bomb guys might be able to tell if we can find more of the detonator."
"All this is fascinating," said Chow, "but when can I get back into my office?"
The fireman didn't care for Chow's attitude, and he made sure Chow understood that by dragging out the questioning, report writing, and calling of the police and the bomb guys as long as possible. It was lunchtime by the time they finally let us go, so I decided to avail myself of some of the neighborhood cuisine. The obvious choice was Tony Squidboy Wu's Dim Sum Restaurant. I walked a block and a half south on Waverly until I came to Sacramento, which at that point was already making its calf-wrenching climb to the top of Nob Hill. The restaurant was interred in a below-ground space just before the intersection with Stockton. It went by the prosaic name of the Pearl Tea House, not Squidboy's Dim Sum Shack as I had hoped, and was surrounded on all sides by buildings that housed Chinese family associations. To the right, the doors for the Moy Family Association were open, and I could see and hear elderly Chinese playing rapid-fire mahjong at seven or eight card tables positioned around the dank, linoleum-tiled room. The vibe for the restaurant was decidedly quieter. The glass door at the bottom of the steps to the restaurant had a sign that said open, as well as a yellow health department advisory notice, but there didn't seem to be any activity within. I put my hand to the door, jangling the little attached bell, but was hit by a sudden attack of prudence. It didn't seem the smartest thing in the world to be heading into the underground headquarters of the gang whose members had nearly fricasseed me the night before without at least a little more reconnaissance. I let go of the door, turned, and went up the steps to street level. There wasn't any place in front of the building to hang out without being painfully obvious, so I went across Sacramento to one of San Francisco's so-called urban playgrounds. A slab of concrete, some monkey bars, a few benches, all surrounded by a high chain-link fence. I settled on a bench next to a calcified drinking fountain that last dispensed water the year Nixon visited China. From there, I had a good view of the entrance to the Pearl Tea House and an old guy doing Tai Chi exercises that somehow reminded me of the creaky but coordinated movements of the wiper blades on my Galaxy 500. The Tai Chi guy had finished all his exercises and sat down to smoke a well-earned cigarette by the time anything interesting happened. A stretch Hummer with tinted windows pulled up in front of the restaurant. Movements inside caused the stiff suspension to shiver, and then a door on the passenger side was flung open, and I could see a bald head appear over the edge of the roof. The head slid from view, and the limo shivered again as the weighty body attached to the head pitched out of the limo. Two heads with black hair, and presumably lighter bodies, peeked over the roof in quick succession and jumped from the limo like paratroopers. The door was slammed shut, and the Hummer made a rumbling noise and surged away. Three men stood on the sidewalk watching the limo depart. The first was a massive, sumo-sized Chinese with a bald head and stubby arms that buoyed away from his torso at a nearly 45-degree angle due to the pneumatic action of the fat surrounding his triceps and chest. He was wearing a t-shirt made from Georgia's entire cotton harvest and a pair of shorts that extended nearly to his ankles. His ankles looked bigger than my thighs. The gleam of a monstrous diamond ring on his right pinky finger was visible from across the street. It had to be Wu. Standing next to him were two other Chinese. They would have been short and slender no matter where they stood, but beside him they were pygmies. They also looked an awful lot like the guys I'd tangled with the night before. Wu nodded at them and then did a slow rotation to face the steps leading to the restaurant. He waded down them with difficulty, the other two following in his wake like fart bubbles after a whale. Somehow, my reconnaissance hadn't made it any easier to follow them in. I stood from the bench deliberately, brushed some pistachio nut shells I had set in off my butt, squared my shoulders, and marched across the street to the Pearl Tea House. There was a reception podium near the front door, but nobody was manning it. I veered left through an arched entryway with a beaded curtain and stepped into the dining area. It was dull, gray, and utilitarian. There were a few cardboard decorations in the shape of giant firecrackers thumbtacked to the wall here and there, and a potted bamboo in the corner that looked more like a cane pole shoved in a bucket of dirt than a live plant. A dozen round tables with paper tablecloths and cheap high-back chairs completed the furnishings, but only one table near the center was occupied. Wu sat at that, holding a Chinese language newspaper about an inch from his face with one hand, while he reached into a vast bowl of boiled peanuts with the other. He hadn't heard me come in. "Catching up with the China Free Press?" I asked when I'd gotten about a foot from his table. He lowered the paper slowly until he could look at me over the top of it. For the first time, I noticed a tattoo of a squid rippling along the folds of his fleshy neck, just below the ear. "I don't read that rag," he said. "It's nothing but yellow journalism." He had a slight British accent. I thought they had a pretty good article on the attempted kidnapping of Lisa Lee in today's edition, especially the stuff about the quick-thinking, heroic bystander who saved the day. "That's cute, Reardon. Did you think that one up while you were sitting on the park bench, trying to grow some balls?" "No, it just came to me. How'd you know I was in the park?" "My cook was doing Tai Chi right across from you. Plus, we have about 10 video cameras mounted on the building pointing that way. Plus, you belong in this neighborhood like Mayo belongs on Mushu. How do you know who I am, then? He grunted. Sit the fuck down. You're giving me a neck ache. I pulled out the chair across from him and sat down. He watched me with bored eyes and then carefully quartered the paper and placed it at his elbow. I know who you are because I spoke to Lenora this morning. On a first-name basis with her, are you? When I need to be. Did you mention why you'd tried to kidnap her daughter? His chair squeaked for help as he leaned back in it and laced his fingers together over his mountainous gut. I didn't. No, you didn't tell her, or no, you didn't try to kidnap Lisa? The latter. You're being over-literal. I saw those two jackdaws from last night get out of your Hummer. You think if I go back to the SFPD and add that detail to the report I filed, it won't result in your ass being hauled down to the station? I wouldn't mention that to the police or Lenora, if I were you. It's well known that Guaylo think that all Chinese look alike. I'm sure you are mistaken. I was working on what undoubtedly would have been a stinging retort when a door behind Wu swung open. The Tai Chi guy from the park stepped through it carrying a plate with a stainless steel serving cover. He banged it down in front of Wu along with a pair of chopsticks. Wu grunted. Bring him some too, he said. The cook stayed long enough to favor me with an ardent scowl and then disappeared through the kitchen door. Wu took a napkin from the table and wedged it under the outermost of his chins. He snatched up the chopsticks and clicked them together exuberantly like they were castanets. Do you like feng jiao? He asked. What's feng jiao? I tried to mimic Wu's pronunciation, but it came out more like fuck now instead. Wu grinned. It's chicken. Only it's a part of the chicken that the colonel doesn't normally put in his bucket. The colonel may have his reasons for that. Not good ones. Apart from the head, and maybe the butt, the feet are the very best part. He swept off the cover, revealing a plate piled high with brown, glutinous-looking talons. He stabbed into the pile with the chopsticks, extracted a single claw, and brought it to his mouth to gnaw on. The cook came back with another serving and set it down in front of me. He pulled off the cover and stood over me, watching as the steam wafted up. I had to admit that the spices smelled good, but I couldn't get past the fact that I'd just been served a plate of amputated feet. The cook saw something in my face that made him cackle. You want some ketchup with that? He asked. I swallowed. No, I said. I'm good. The cook cackled again and returned to the kitchen. Wu leaned down to spit out some bones and dabbed his mouth with his napkin. It takes a little while to master the proper technique for eating feng jiao. The bones in particular, you sort of have to root them out with your tongue. But it's good practice. You tell Lisa Lee that you're a chicken feet eater and watch her eyes light up. I slapped the table, making all the chicken feet do a little tap dance. Everyone I meet today seems to want to make a crack about my relationship with Lisa Lee. Well, I didn't come here for that, and I didn't come for half-assed lessons in Chinese cuisine. Wu looked at me with a mild expression, then returned to his chicken foot. He gnawed on it expertly, rotating as he did so it was like a tiny cord on the cob. He leaned down to dispose of more bones and looked back up at me. Why exactly did you come here, Reardon? The right answer was I'd come about the election, but things had changed since I'd identified Wu's men. I said, I came to find out why you attacked Lisa Lee. We went over that already. Not to my satisfaction. I've got a knife covered with your man's fingerprints in a sealed plastic bag. The truth was I'd left it in my car glove box, and I'd probably smeared all the prints. I've also got an eyewitness who will testify about the attack. Wu pointed his chopsticks at me with a fresh chicken foot clasped in them. Lisa Lee won't. I cut him off. It's not Lisa Lee, I said. It's someone in the band who'll say whatever I want him to say. He shrugged. I never put too much credence in what so-called eyewitnesses say. It's surprising how often they change their stories before trial. As to the knife, it'll be quite easy to detain you here while someone searches your office and apartment. I pushed back my chair and jumped to my feet. Look, Wu. His eyes ranged over my shoulder and he said, grab him. I twisted around to confront my attacker, but closed on empty air. Wu's laugh rang out behind me. Do you think if I was going to tell one of my employees to grab you, I would do it in English? He was already working on the next chicken foot when I turned back to look at him. Sit down, Reardon, he said between bites. We both know you're not going to the police with this. I stood there awkwardly for a moment, then took hold of the chair and moved it to the side where I could keep my eye on the entrance and the kitchen door. What do you mean? I went to the station house this morning. Yes, but my friends at the station say your report doesn't mention you having a knife, and it certainly doesn't mention anything about Lisa Lee. He nods some more on the foot, then came up for air. I'll tell you what, Reardon, I'll throw you a bone, so to speak. Lenora and I were having a little disagreement. She had something of mine, and for her own reasons was withholding it. I am not completely lacking in empathy. I understood her viewpoint, but could not condone it. I discussed the matter with her, but she was obdurate. I tried other means of persuasion. They did not work. So I decided to obtain something she valued highly. To trade. Yes, to trade. And although you prevented me from obtaining that highly valued thing, the mere threat of losing it was enough to change her mind. He smiled at me greasily. I got what I wanted from her this morning. And now you two are buddy-buddy. Wu was hoovering his chicken foot again, but he nodded and made an affirmative sucking noise. I reached over to the bowl of peanuts and selected one. The boiled shell split open like wet newspaper. You know, Wu, you're pretty well-spoken for a thuggish gang leader. I can't remember the last time I heard someone use the word obdurate in a sentence. Probably it was a public TV show on diamond mines. He dropped the foot he was working on into a pile of denuded claws and made a mock bow. I read for a degree at New College, Oxford, before life's other priorities gained precedence. And I am not a gang leader. I am the president of a Chinese business association. I scooped the nuts out of the peanut shell and popped them into my mouth. I know I shouldn't talk with my mouth full, but Wu was already becoming one with his next chicken foot and didn't seem to notice. Alan Chow says you're head of Wohop Toe, the only gang in San Francisco. Wu chuckled. Chow, what a doormat. I leave more personality on my dental floss than he displays all year. You said you tried other means of persuasion to get what you wanted from the Dragon Lady. Did that include fixing the election so her candidate lost? Wu stopped his grazing and looked me dead in the eye. He laughed. Shaking his head, he put the chicken foot down and wiped his mouth with a napkin. Where did you come up with that one? A footless bird told me. If I wanted to torpedo Chow, there'd be plenty of easier ways to do it than rigging the election. And whatever I might think of Chow personally, I am not opposed to having a Chinese mayor. I wouldn't have tried to prevent his election to settle my dispute with Lenora. How about scaring him with a dud letter bomb, then? Wu held his face rigidly for a moment and then brought the napkin up to blow his nose. He made a thoughtful study of the results and set the napkin to the side, on top of the newspaper. I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about, he said finally. Or maybe you meant him to open it weeks ago, perhaps during the election. He shrugged. If Chow opened a dud letter bomb during the election, it would only serve to bring him more publicity. You can imagine the headline, "Crusading Chinese mayoral candidate risks ire of Chinatown gangs," that sort of thing. And the threat of his murder might have scared the Dragon Lady into giving you what you wanted. He coughed into a fist bigger than a truck piston. I think you're reading the tea leaves a little too much, Reardon. He called something in Chinese over his shoulder, and the kitchen door swung open to discharge the cook, this time carrying an evil-looking cleaver smeared with blood and chicken feathers. It's time for you to go. I wish you the best of luck in your assignment for Lenora, but don't make the mistake of coming back here again or saying anything more to the police. You won't find me quite so accommodating. The cook came up to hold the cleaver about an inch from my right ear. I leaned away from the blade. What? No fortune cookie? No cookie, said the cook. Just the fortune. Get lost or get chopped. I sidled out of the chair and stood. I reached across the surprised cook to grab a handful of peanuts and then headed towards the exit. Thanks for lunch, I said over my shoulder. When I reached the beaded archway, I turned to look back at them. Wu was already demolishing his next chicken foot, and the cook had taken my place across from him. His cleaver was embedded on the table near his elbow, still quivering. I had the uneasy feeling of having been played. I tugged on my earlobe and went quietly away from there. You have been listening to Runoff, a book hard-boiled great James Crumley described as a smart, funny, spooky, often touching, always entertaining romp. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.